Welcome to the Perry Johnson Laboratory Accreditation Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to the laboratory accreditation industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you'd like to tune into our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjlabs.com or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our webinar on 17043, which is the general requirements for the competence of reference material producers. My name is Tracy Sersen, and I will be assisting our program manager, Doug Berg, today on this webinar on the requirements of reference material producer accreditation. So today we're gonna give everyone an overview of the 17034 standard requirements for reference material producers. And this webinar is actually gonna educate not just reference material producers and what they need to know to become accredited, but also for the laboratories. So just like in the testing area, many laboratories have to use calibration laboratories, for example, to calibrate their equipment. So it's really good to know what is exactly expected even of those calibration facilities. So you know what you're getting, you know what to ask for, you know what they go through as an accredited facility. And then we're gonna have some time and opportunity for some questions at the end. Okay, so again, thank you everyone for joining us. Again, my name is Tracy Sersen, and I am the president of PGLA, working with Doug Berg today, our long-term program manager. I'm also gonna be his MC if he needs any assistance with questions or anything that comes up during the course of this webinar. Doug has been with us for a very long time and has been in the industry for a very long time, as you can see on his bio. He's been in the industry for 45 years plus in testing, calibration, laboratory operations, engineering, and management. He's worked for several organizations, the US EPA and GM. Since retiring, has worked with accreditation organizations as an assessor and program manager. He's currently our testing program manager. He serves on the ILAC committees, as well as the APAC committees, and is an APAC evaluator for PGLA. So with that, I'd like to welcome Doug, and I will let you get to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. We're obviously not going to go into a deep dive into each of the sections of the ISO 17034 2016 document, but we're going to talk about some of the specifics of it and nuances. We are going to spend a little bit of time on terminology so that people we can see with that, then also some finer points regarding what's a reference material, what's a certified reference material, and so forth. So we're going to give you an overview of the ISO 17034 2016 standard, and which is forms the basis for any type of accreditation or reference material producers. We'll look at some aspects of that's critical to reference material production, such as requirements on limitations of subcontracting, production planning. We'll talk about some of the key points that make reference materials, the homogeneity, stability, how to determine and assign property values and their uncertainties. And then the important part of this is documents that are appropriate for the reference material and labeling and some things involving distribution. So this webinar will be educational for currently accredited reference material providers and also those who might be seeking this accreditation. And I think really at this point, as Tracy had indicated, for laboratories interested in just exactly what reference material producers are required to have in place to become accredited. So the ISO 17034 2016 is the general requirements for the competence of reference material producers. That is the requirements document. That's the normative document. But there are three supplemental guides, and they are guides, so they're there for information purposes. One is ISO Guide 30-2015. It's for reference materials, selective terms and definitions. Those are quite important to have a common understanding of what the terminology is. ISO Guide 31 for reference materials is contents of certificates, labels, and accompanying documentation. And ISO Guide 35 reference materials, general and statistical principles for certification. That's not a certification of them as obviously as reference material producers, but certification of the properties and determination of the properties of the reference materials themselves. And you say, well, what, you know, what's the concern with reference materials and certified reference materials? Well, we go back to ISO IEC 17025, 2017, it's then 652, it says the laboratory shall ensure that measurement results are traceable to the international system, SI, through one of the following. And there's a list of those. And what I have here is the second one, where it says certified values of certified reference materials provided by a competent producer with a stated metrological traceability to the SI. So in other words, they're going to have values, these reference materials are going to have certified values back to the SI directly, the seven fundamental measurements and their combinations. And there's a note there that says that reference material producers fulfilling the requirements of ISO 17034 are considered to be competent. So if you have something where there's a reference material going to be produced that actually provides a traceable value to an SI unit and or combinations, then that's the item that applies in that case. Of course, we know that not everything is in a sense traceable to the SI, things like color match and things of that nature. So here it says when metrological traceability of the SI units is not technically possible, a laboratory shall demonstrate metrological traceability to an appropriate reference. And it says that certified values of certified reference materials provided by a competent provider, in this case, is one of the items. It's the main item there. So that's where we see we want to get how do we determine providers are competent? Would they necessarily provide the certified values? And then what would be applicable in each of these two cases? So when we talk about reference material providers, who are those? What are those organizations or people anyway? So it's a body that can be an organization or company, public or private, that is fully responsible for project planning and management, assignment of and the decision on property values and their relevant uncertainties, authorization of the property value. So in other words, a decision made on it, and then there's an authorization, a formal authorization made, and the issuance of a reference material certificate or other statements for the reference material it produces. So that being said, well, we've got a little bit better understanding what a reference material provider is. What actually is a reference material? So that's a reference material is some material, it's got something that is sufficiently homogeneous and stable with respect to one or more specified properties, which has been established to be fit for its intended use in a measurement process. So it's fit for use in a measurement process. And it says that the reference material, some notes here, reference materials is a generic term. Properties can be quantitative or qualitative. That is, things like just simply identity or color or something of that nature, in addition to having something that would be measured in micrograms per milliliter or something like that. The uses for reference materials can include the calibration of a measurement system, assessment of a measurement procedure, assigning values to other materials, and be used in quality control type purposes. Now, what is a certified reference material? Well, so you could be fairly flip and just say, well, a certified reference material is a reference material that has a certificate with it. But it actually goes a little bit deeper than that. So it's a material characterized by a metrologically valid procedure for one or more specified properties, accompanied by a reference material certificate. There's where the certificate enters in, that provides the value of the specified property, its associated uncertainty, and a statement of metrological traceability. And again, that traceability can be, in a sense, an identity item as well. So the concept of value includes a nominal property or a qualitative attribute such as identity or sequence, and uncertainties for such attributes can be expressed either in an expression of probability of levels of confidence. Metrological valid procedures for the production and certification of reference materials are given in, among other things, Guide 35. So we're going to see where these guides come in. Next note is ISO Guide 31 gives reference on guidance on the contents of reference material certificates, and ISO IEC Guide 99/2007 has a similar definition for a certified reference material. And that's my spot. Excuse me. There we go. So we've had these terms that we've seen in some of these definitions, and it says, well, we talked about, it has about uniformity, it has about homogeneity, it has stability. So what is homogeneity? Well, it's the uniformity of the specified property value throughout a defined portion of the reference material. So it could be a unit of reference material in some sort of small single-use container up to a particular batch that's being containerized, or it could be homogeneity over several batches. And we'll talk about that in the subsequent slides a bit. So again, it can be a single unit in a batch, or it can be the entire batch, or it can be batch to batch. Between unit homogeneity is the uniformity of a specified property value among units of the reference material. So if you're bottling up ampules or some sort of other container, then it's how homogeneous is it within that particular production batch, for example. Within unit homogeneity is the specified property value within a unit. So for example, there could be something that settles out in the unit and has to be, before use, it has to be agitated or sonicated or something of that nature. It could be that the could be a color related item. It could be mixing of the materials. It could be something that doesn't mix well, but you'd want it to be evenly distributed throughout the reference material, and so forth. If your reference material is a hardness testing block, then you'd want to make sure that the unit that block is made such and presented such that you get a consistent value throughout the surface of the block. Stability. Well, that's the characteristic of the reference material when it's stored under specified conditions. So a lot of times some things have to be refrigerated, some things have to be frozen, and so that will improve the stability in many cases. Conversely, you can have other things where if you let it get too cold, then it becomes non-homogeneous, or if you let it get too hot, it becomes it degrades. So stability is a term that's relevant or relative to the storage conditions and also what property value you're looking at. And there's it also is, you know, it's, if you think about it, we it's almost inherent that there, it's over a specified period of time. So you can store some things for, just like you can food items in your own refrigerator, you can store them. It makes them, preserves them, and extends their useful life, but you can't necessarily keep something in the refrigerator forever, at least as anybody who's ever had to clean out the back of a shelf, you hadn't rotated very much. So the so there's that aspect. It's conditions and time period. Now there's another important factor on is what they call transportation stability. So in other words, you've made it, you've stored it, somebody wants it, you take it out of your as a reference material or producer, you take it out of the storage. Now you got to get it to the customer. So it has to be packaged up. It's got to be put in appropriate containerization. You might have to keep it cold. You might have to put ice packs or equivalents in with it. You also want to find out if there's something that in shipping it that there's likelihood that it could be exposed to extremes of either heat or cold, and to see what the effect of that is. And that's part of your evaluation of stability, to study that. There was a company that we accredited that one of the things, it wasn't a product that we accredited them for as a reference material producer, but it was a reference material that they were trying to figure out what its stability was to ship it to Alaska. And they thought that that would be a good idea, a good way of determining its resistance to being cold or frozen. And in discussions with the various transport companies, they said, no. Alaska's actually got, where most of the people live in Alaska, it's not overly cold. They said, if you really want to test how it is, ship it by land to northwestern Montana in the wintertime. They said that's much more of a test of how it can handle cold weather and being, maybe set inside the or on the steps or something like that of the company. Trying to find my button here. Long-term stability is just that. That's what you, as a producer, you'd like to be able to have something that's fairly stable over the long term. So when you make a batch of it, you're able to kind of get your value out of the time and materials that went into that batch, and be able to recover that that investment of resources over a period of time. The thing there is it part of that has to be looked at in terms of your ability to keep it, keep those conditions, such as whatever you need for long-term stability, and factoring in that you've got to get it eventually to the customers without having some sort of serious degradation in what their expected period of use would be. Now, lifetime stability is something that most of the companies actually kind of check out and monitor, in the sense that they might put a use-by date on the reference material, but they might themselves keep samples well beyond that date, and they periodically will pull them out with the idea of trying to determine what exactly is the time period where the usefulness of the product knees over, you might say, in time, because that would lead them to perhaps extend the stability, the use by time period, and have the basis for doing so. So it's all, a lot of times that what you're trying to find is where do you really get that point where your reference material properties no longer maintain the assigned values. When do the assigned values begin to change? Now, the period of validity is the time interval during which the producer of the reference material warrants the stability. So that's why I think most folks have some experience with that with certain types of materials. Although at the very end, we're going to see some examples where that could be a very long time indeed. So I would think another would be for folks who do any type of hardness testing. The clock is normally not an issue with the hardness testing blocks, so you can have them for quite a bit of time. And in fact, we actually have a laboratory that uses some reference materials that were developed by the what's now NIST, which used to be the National Bureau of Standards, back in the 19-teens. And they have the sheets on that material, and they periodically check and verify that material is in fact stable. It'd be something that it's one of these things that if you suspected that it was changing, you'd have to describe what the physical or chemical mechanism would be to make it change. And if you could verify that, you'd probably win the Nobel Prize in that case. But there are materials that just last for a fairly long time. Now, commutability is a property of a reference material that's demonstrated by looking at the data from the results of one or more measurement procedures for a reference material. So you could check it with maybe a flame ionization detector, and you could do something with another type of analyzer, and then you compare the results. So it's saying that reference material, it may be different, in which case you'd say, well, it's different for application with this type of analyzer here or this type of process here, but you've determined what that difference, you could quantify what that difference is and describe it and mathematically kind of justify it from a statistical basis. Now, this is probably old hat to folks, but as you got to remember, ISO 17034 is an ISO standard. So one of the things with certain definitions and things of that nature, they reach back to other documents in many cases and make sure that people, you know, that there's a common definition for things. So we will see where they're in this presentation, where there'll be references to a process for producing a reference material. So what is a process? Well, a process, a uniform definition of that, it's a set of interrelated interacting activities that use inputs to deliver an intended result. So it's a way of getting outputs from inputs. So that intended result could be an output, it could be a product, or it could be a service, you know, but I think we would probably look at it from in reference material production, that'd probably be a product and or some output from it, some behavior from it, or perhaps. So in general, I think, and we all understand that, you know, that you have, most things are interrelated processes. So the output of one is the input to another, and things of that nature, and two or more interrelated and interacting processes, these can be referred to as a process and so forth. But that's all common in our understanding of from ISO 9000 itself, not 9001, this is ISO 9000, the actual common definition. Now, so a process in an organization are usually planned and carried out under controlled conditions to add value. And we'll talk about those in a sense when we start looking at what the functions and within the product, the determination and production of reference materials. And a process where the conformity of the result cannot be readily or economically validated is currently referred to as a special process. So these are all common terms that you tend to see throughout the, not just from ISO 9000, but also to ISO 9001, and then typically to the others like ISO 17025, ISO 17034, and so forth. And a procedure is a way of carrying out an activity or a process. And so when we use the word here, procedure, in the end, it's a way of carrying out that process, doing that process or doing that activity. And the thing there is, and we'll talk a little bit, is procedures can be documented or not. So part of the assessment process is to be aware of that and look at it in light of what the particular material being produced is, and perhaps the material reference material producer themselves. You can't have a discussion about any of the ISO standards anymore without talking about risk. But so I am going to talk about risk. It's the effect of uncertainty. So if you think about a reference material, part of what you're going to be doing in terms of estimating homogeneity, some of what you're doing in terms of stability, all those aspects of stability where you're looking at long term, where you're looking at distribution stability and so forth, is you're trying to in a sense assess and address the risk involved with and the uncertainty of the property values and the property values over time. So in our experience with various folks with reference materials, part of the assessment, as we kind of all looked at, was things like what is the actual use by date, what's the actual expiration date, however that wants to be determined, is that you're balancing off some data, what you know about the product and its over time, and then assessing what's the risk of having that product perhaps degrade or transcend through a value where it's just no longer functionally usable or prone to give increasingly bad results or something of that nature. So it's the part of what a reference material producer has to do is looking at that at risks. So they gotta, and that can even be from their own business standpoint, that they get into somebody might have an idea that they want to produce a certain reference material. It could be quite expensive to do so, but it looks like there's a good market for it, but there may be issues involving its stability, its storage, its other factors like that, that you say would be much more risky, and so therefore they may or may not choose to pursue that. One of the things we'll see in this, there will be references as you read through the standard, and I encourage any folks who, if you are interested in the standard, make sure they purchase it and read it, as there'll be certain things, or just like all the other ISO standards, where it says something needs to be documented. There needs to be something of that, a document, needs to be recorded or something like that. So just remember that documented information is required to be controlled and maintained by an organization and the medium on which it is contained. So you have the information, the content of it, so to speak, but also the medium has to be maintained. So it can be in any type of format or media, and it can refer to the management system, or it can refer to processes. There we get back to our processes again, and information can required to the in order for the organization to operate, but just and also the evidence of results achieved, in other words, records. So throughout the ISO 17034. There's a need for having records and record retention on batches and things of that nature for defined periods of time. Unknown caller. Forgot to mute the phone. Now, what's a record? Well, it's a document, but it states the results achieved and provides evidence of the activities performed. So we'll see throughout that, that whenever it says a record, well, what does that kind of mean? obviously different people think different things, but in general, it can be used for to formalize traceability, to provide could be traceability of product or traceability of property values, or could provide evidence of verification and things of that nature. So let's get busy on ISO 17034:2016. So I'll keep all those terms in mind because they're going to pop up in some of these subsequent slides. So when you encounter them, you kind of say, oh, okay, we kind of got the flavor of that. So the structure is it's got all of the ISO documents are following as they go through revision processes in the last few years have been following the same structure. So, and that's that comes out of a part of ISO called CASCO, the Conformity Assessment Activity. And they noted over time that various documents were being generated and they all served, they all were worthwhile, they were all, but they seemed to be structured differently. Sometimes there was inconsistent use of terminology. Also, they felt that there was maybe a little bit of, there were opportunities where organizations that say were certified to ISO 9001 for a broader range of activities, but inside of there might have been a reference material production activity. And they said, well, as long as that's that activity is covered by the ISO 9000 system, then there's certain things that would be common to any management system or quality system that then would be addressed by that. And so therefore, to give the chance to focus more on those things that are specific. And we have that, and we'll look at that in a minute, for ISO 17034. So the first part, it says, well, what's the scope of the document? Well, it addresses the components of the RMPs, the reference material producers, and their consistent operation. And it will address the production of all reference materials, including certified reference materials. So you have reference materials and you have certified reference materials. And the single normative reference, in other words, another requirements reference in the 17034 is ISO IEC 17025. So you don't have to keep putting 2015 on it. They just say whatever the latest edition is. So that's the general requirements for the competence of testing and calibration laboratories. And like I think most folks are familiar, even with the 17025, you got some general requirements on things about contractual matters and how you deal with the customers and things of that nature, that the organization should be impartial, and that the information that's shared by customers is kept confidential and like that. And that you see the same thing in the not to go too far afield with the 17043 in proficiency testing, for example. Now, in structural requirements, I think we're all very familiar. It ought to be a legal entity of some sort in whatever economy that particular organization is in. So you have to, there is a, and the structure of them and the definition of those legal entities might vary a little bit from economy to economy or country to country. There are organizational requirements, and there needs to be clear identification, even within if it's a broader organization, what are the specific responsibilities and authorities for all people affecting the reference materials? So what happens here is you can say, well, there's the broader organization. Here's the activity that produces the reference material. So you focus in on that particular activity since that's what we would be accrediting. You look for managerial positions, again, for those things that are specific to the reference material production and also technical management so you get the kind of like the business side of it and the technical side of it, and the people need to be technically competent in the processes of the reference material production. Now, the other thing, as it says, is that the authority for the reference material activity under 17034 Needs direct access. Well, to whom? I mean, the CEO of the corporation? No, it just says to the highest level of in the organization that makes decisions on reference material policy and production. So you don't necessarily have to go to the top of the organization. It could be something that's in a division or a particular plant or something like that. So that's one of the things that you have to kind of look at. And of course, there's resource requirements on personnel, that personnel should be certainly competent to perform the tasks that are outlined in the for that organization providing those reference materials. Now, that also then gets into, well, what sort of activities must the reference material producer do? And you'd say, well, they should have competent lab personnel. Well, if they actually do laboratory analysis of the material themselves, but then again, they may not have to. They might contract that out. So it's, you know, they'd say, well, I don't need a PhD in chemistry because we don't do any chemical analysis here. Now, so you got to kind of look at that. Subcontracting is an important part. One of the things we'll kind of touch base on, and there can be a fair amount of subcontracting that can be done in the reference material area. It actually, in our experience, for the reference material producers that we accredit, you see very little, if any, subcontracting. So practically none in most cases. Got to look at equipment, services, suppliers. Again, that goes back to what are the actual activities done by the reference material producer themselves. And with that, facilities and environmental conditions is another thing. For example, the reference material may have certain a reference material producer may have certain materials that need to be kept in some particular environmental state, and they actually subcontract that out to a company that does that, and then dispenses that material out of that storage area to their customers. So that would be allowable under that. Now, under the technical and production requirements for RMP, now we're talking about, well, what are kind of like the various steps? Well, one of them is, and we'll kind of recap these to get an idea of what become the core processes, you might say, for being a reference material producer. You got production planning, production control. Again, there's extensive amount of material in each one of these that needs to be part of the assessment process to look at this. Material handling and storage, material processing, measurement procedures, measuring equipment, data integrity and evaluation, metrological traceability of certified values, and the assessment of homogeneity, the assessment and monitoring of stability, characterization. Characterization is the actual laying out of how you're going to determine what the property values are. So it could be that you're going to do something within the organization, just within your organization. It may be something where you may do some testing within your organization, but you send some, you maybe send two or more samples out to other laboratories that are also, you deem to be competent. It could be accredited or not. And then you get those results back. And then, well, what's the plan then for how are you going to handle that data to determine what the property value? And maybe with that, you'd send out things so you could determine stability and so forth. So it's the characterization is how you plan to characterize it. Now, one of the things that it says in there, because it's got all sorts of little in this section, but one of them says that a very valid way of doing it is just through the mixing of you know, do it, by mass or volume of the material itself in-house. So that's your, in other words, you're characterizing the property value based on the measurement of the material and either through a volumetric or gravimetric type means. So that's, then given that, you've had a characterization kind of study laid out, then what do you do with the data? What, you know, how do you assign the property values and how do you go about determining their uncertainties where that's applicable? Now with that, then the next part would be our reference material documents and labels. So it could be something that a reference material could simply have a label on it, and maybe needs to have a label on it given whatever the contents are because of, you know, the type of material that's in it. Now, when you have a certified reference material, again, we kind of talked about that earlier, is that's where there's a certificate involved. So therefore, the filling out of, you know, the certificate. Now, it has a list of things that would go on to a certificate, but some of those are relative to and conditioned by, well, what kind of material actually is it? You know, that is it a lump of something? Is it pulverized material? Is it a liquid and suspend, you know, something in suspension? Is it a mixture, et cetera, et cetera? Then also the control of your records. How long would you keep it? Obviously, if you are going to have things out in the field, or you're going to have people that have a fairly, they might have a certain shelf life on the material, use by date, expiration date, then you would certainly want to keep records so that you can produce those to substantiate that material at least to that date, if not maybe a couple cycles beyond that. And then what happens if you do get non-conforming work? Now, non-conforming work could be when you have to, how do you rotate stock in your shelf, in your storage area to make sure that you don't send something out. Hopefully you wouldn't send it out after the expiration date, but the big thing is you don't want to send it up, charge somebody full price for it and send it out so they only have 1 month's worth of life on the package. That would not be a good idea. So most reference material producers that have that, they have a date by which they will pull that material off with the idea that the customer, if they ship it to them, they will have a certain known period of time before the material expires, and they will probably then use the material within that time period. And then the handling of complaints. Now, the management system aspect of things, gee, 17034 looks a lot like 17025. Yes, and that's by design. So it too has option A and option B. In fact, if you notice, the 17034 came out of the ISO pipeline a year ahead of 17025. So this was one of those that was standards that was affected by the decision by Casco to take these types of things and put it out into the end of the document, and then also say, well, these could be, doesn't mean they are, but they could be dealt with through the process of certification or to ISO 9001 for a broader organization. So you got things here: quality policy, general management system documentation, control of that documentation, control of records, management review, internal audits, actions to address risks and opportunities, corrective actions, improvement, feedback from customers, and so forth. So a couple of our reference material producers, they have certain things that they in evaluating products and things of that nature, they look at in terms of risk. And so therefore, you know, and that risk could either be the type of material it is in general. It could be that the material is fairly hazardous. It could be that the material requires some sort of very secure storage under very exacting conditions. And they say, well, that's something we probably would not choose to get into and things of that nature. So it affects the products they get into. They make those types of decisions. Also makes this, they make decisions as to where that maybe perhaps opportunities are in terms of the their what they are doing compared to others in the same general product group. Now, I had said earlier, you know, it's, if you read this, the document, you say, well, I can be a reference material producer and I don't have to have a laboratory. That's true. I don't have to do this. I don't have to do that. But there are some things that the reference material producer has to do. They cannot subcontract these processes. They can't subcontract the product planning. They have to own the product planning and the production planning. They have to they have to select any subcontractors that would be used, and they have to ensure that those subcontractors are competent. Now, they have to assign the property values. So remember, the property values get determined as a result of the characterization activity. Notice the characterization activity is not in this list. So that, but the actual determination of what the property values are and their uncertainties, and you're going to authorize those property values and uncertainties, in other words, that and kind of in a sense take ownership of them, even though that all of the work that was done could have been subcontracted. That's a key part, of the being a reference material producer. And then the other is the authorization of the reference material documents. So you could technically have somebody that would subcontract out the actual formatting of the documents and putting perhaps numbers in various fields. However, the actual authorization of the document and issuance of it is a required, can't be subcontracted out. It's required of the reference material producer. So the reference material producer has to also establish and maintain procedures to assess all the tasks that subcontractors perform comply with the requirements set by the RMP and relevant clauses of 17034. So they have to take ownership of the, in a sense, of the work that the subcontractors would do, and have procedures in place and processes in place to assess that those tasks are being done as they have determined they needed to be done. So then they also then would have to maintain records of subcontractor competence, including evaluations and any audits that they might conduct. In other words, the reference material producer may conduct some sort of audits, or the reference material producer is going to rely on subcontractors that have appropriate either certifications and or accreditations by people like Perry Johnson Laboratory Accreditation. And that would include things like evidence of assessments and PT participation, certification where that's appropriate, accreditation where that's appropriate, and other things, other materials that would give evidence that the subcontractors are in fact competent and they're being monitored by the reference material producer. So again, the material that's at the core of being a reference material producer, as opposed to a laboratory, so to speak, in terms of these, what's the difference between 17025 and 17034? Well, it's production planning and control, material handling and storage. It's a little repetitious, but it's a different type of assessment. Material processing, measurement procedures and equipment. That's pretty common with 17025. Certified values and metrological traceability. That's something certainly we encounter in 17025. Assessment of homogeneity, assessment of stability, the characterization as the planning and so forth of how you're going to determine property values and uncertainties. And again, the documents and labels and the distribution and service. In other words, what does it look like when it's in, because sometimes it might be stored in maybe a larger container, say there's some reference material producers that produce things like metals dissolved in hydrochloric acid, that they actually store the material in some fairly large carboys. And then what they do is, that's the lot that they make. And then as they tap out of that lot into maybe sublots that they would then package up into 100 milliliter, 500 milliliter, whatever type containers and seal them up. They have to then study those because they've been in storage. So they have to get making sure that the verifying that the concentrations are have been stable. They're stable. That's where you get into the stability period. And then in turn, they have to be able to ship that in an appropriate manner for shipping, in this case, an acid type material and getting it to the customer in a so it's not damaged, but also that it's in a suitable type of sealing and so forth. And we're going to see some examples here in a little bit of things people do to seal things and so forth. So in a sense, the assessment process, and for we're going to have some assessors in the audience, and I think also we have some people who are just interested in this. We have to check the processes, we have to check documents and records, we got to be looking at each type of RM or CRM. We might not look at each and every RM and CRM within a group, but we're going to be looking at accounting for similar materials or similar processing, and we're going to look at the previous data on previous materials. But again, the reference material producer has to have information on all the materials. So we would just assess those things like we normally do when we're looking at testing and other things of that nature, where we're in a sense looking at exemplars or samples or representative samples, things like that. So let's take a look at some reference materials and CRMs. What is a CRM? It's a reference material where it's issued with a certificate, and the certificate meets certain expectations, and usually that means there's an assigned value and uncertainties in those types of cases. So this is a cylinder. We've been accrediting an organization, a compressed gas company, a gas mixture company called Praxair for some time. Praxair now has been merged into the Linde organization. And so just while I was on an assessment just a week and a half, or about, it'd be 2 weeks ago this week, the formal announcement went out that they're changing their name to Linde Gas and Equipment. So there's going to be a transition here. But what this is a cylinder of normally hydrocarbon mixtures. They make a large number of these of various types of mixtures. And these are used for calibrating equipment in plants, safety monitoring equipment, looking for explosive levels and things of that nature, or things that could be asphyxiants. They are recognized in the industry for having these are small cylinders. That's that cylinder is probably 18 inches, 24 inches, somewhere no bigger than that. And they ship those. That's why I have the box and the container in there, and they also have an arrangement where they have a tear-off type label that they can put on the box, and they ship the empty back to them, and they are able to recycle, reuse those. So, but this is the Linde organization also has another reference material production facility that we accredit, and it's located in Los Angeles. Now, they don't make necessarily cylinders like this. They make EPA protocol gases, which are different, same type of function, or they're used for things like looking at exhaust emission analysis and so forth. And then they also make out there and issue NIST traceable reference materials, and that's under a NIST program. So they ship these, now in this case, these types of smaller cylinders are shipped around the world. That's another thing that's interesting about this company, this particular operation, because now you get involved with not only shipping something on FedEx or UPS, you're talking about shipping something to China, or you're talking about shipping something to Singapore or something of that nature. So they have a way of using freight forwarders and so forth to do that. Very interesting operation. Similarly, we have this is a cylinder. If you look, one of the things that we talk about with a certified reference material, and we talk about labeling. So if you notice, there's a kind of an industry standard label on a high pressure cylinder, and then also if you notice in that plastic container is the actual certificate. This is produced by Ilmo Products. They're located in Illinois. And they're accredited by us for testing, calibration, and reference material production. And this is actually an internal standard, because they too have to document their traceability, that they use to analyze smaller mailable units that are filled up, distributed, and much like the previous slide, but a little bit smaller even, that are used to calibrate breath alcohol analyzers. And that's kind of an important thing in a sense. I'm sitting in the state of Michigan, and in the state of Michigan, we had a little issue of here a couple of years ago where a company contracted by the state police to calibrate, and they would calibrate with these gases as well, analyzers that the state police had purchased and given to various counties and other law enforcement groups within the state of Michigan had ran afoul of falsifying data and things of that nature. So it ended up that put over 10,000 convictions in question, and I think they're still working through that. I'm not certain because I haven't followed up on it. But so that's you say, well, somebody's got to produce those gases. Well, Ilmo is one of the companies that does so. Now the other is that they also make NIST research grade gas materials. So not just the mixtures that are used to calibrate instruments in the field, but they also manufacture alcohol mixtures, and they send those to NIST, and NIST then certifies them as research gas materials. So in a sense, if you look at that, is Ilmo using NIST as a subcontractor in that regard? Because that's something to think about. Okay, now this is by another one of our accredited providers, Chem Service, located in Pennsylvania. They make they tend to make reference materials that the big guys who want to the bigger folks just don't, you know, they don't want to be bothered with, because they're not the single metal in a hydrochloric acid that you mix up a big carboy. Instead, their batches tend to be quite small, or relatively small. They make primarily pesticide and herbicide mixtures, things of that nature, among other things. I said, if you notice, this is it's off on the left side there. That's a glass ampule, so that's filled and sealed, and this is a certified reference material. And we credit them for testing and reference material. Now, one of the things that you have a problem with some small container as well, how do you put a label on it? So there is a provision in 17034 that says you can do this or that, but then there's other things that you have to do with any type of material of this nature to indicate the safety indicators and very unambiguous identification and who's it made by and so forth. So one of the ways to worry about that is, well, how, and plus if you print it real small, you can't, you know, the label, you can't read it. So you got to have something that's readable, or it defeats the purpose of having a label. So what ChemService did here is they put on a real label, if you notice, and that is affixed to the ampule. And then when they go to package this, they kind of roll that up and stick that into units that they ship these in, where they will ship quite a few of these. They have several layers of protection so that the material doesn't, if there's damage, it doesn't leak out and so forth. It's a very, very, they put a lot of thought into that. But I thought it's interesting that one solution to the label problem is just put a decent label on it and let it go. But they're widely, they distribute this widely. They have a outlet for the EU, and then they ship things elsewhere as well. So, and then the other is they make neat material. That's stuff that might be in powder form or chunk form or something of that nature, but it's not mixed. It's not solution. And this is also a CRM. And if you look, they same thing with the label. So that's the, and they ship these in the same way, shape, or form that they do the ampules. Oops, sorry about that. Now, that just in comparison, and just does folks, these are folks, this is a company called Lab Instruments in Italy that we accredit for testing in RMP. And they do the same thing, but they have their information on the label, and then that label information links to the document, also the documentation that they submit with the material. So this is but they also have these single use ampules. Oops, excuse me. And they have other material that is not in ampule form, but is still obviously sealed. So, and again, they export material all over the world. Now, here's something. You look at this. I don't know. There's probably people in the audience that might be involved in a lot of times things involving oil or oil testing or other types of things like solvents and so forth. That there are a variety of ASTM tests where they use copper strips as the actual test item. Now, the copper strip itself is a reference material, if you think about it. And but they also then you would subject it to whatever the test method is. It could be a rotating pressure vessel test, or it could be just simply dropping a copper strip and some material for 24 hours or 48 hours, or you do salt spray testing, or and you use put the copper strips in and evaluate whether or not the level of the saline solution is giving you what you think it should have over a period of time. So to evaluate that, the ASTM itself has this item, which you purchase, and you would then match the specimen that you have after you subjected it to the test method that you have, and you from that determine, well, is it a 2E or a 2D, you know, that sort of thing. So now they recognize that this itself is subject to, from a stability standpoint, could be damaged if not kind of handled appropriately. So one of the things they do with this is they issue this with a packet, a sealed envelope type thing, self-sealing envelope, and then they tell you to put it back. You use it to use it, then you put it back in the envelope, and you put the envelope in something like a drawer and close the drawer. So it's kind of like in the dark, in the envelope. Because I have seen these where they have obviously been out for a while, and I'm not the greatest person with color, as most people know, but I can kind of see where they've kind of changed. So that's certainly, now you'd say, well, is this a, gee, this isn't traceable to the SI, you know? You say, no, but it's traceable to a reference. It's traceable to the material, and the material is accepted by the people who developed the tests at ASTM and is used then across the board on several different types of tests. So it is a reference. Similarly, for those who like to deal with things like paint or fabric, the American Association of Textile Colorists, Chemists and Colorists has a scale that you measure fade with. So you could say, take a piece of fabric and wash it 200 times and then look at how much it fades. You could put it inside an old carbon arc exposure system and have it subjected to extremely bright light for a specified period of time, or the newer xenon arc units. And then you take that out and you evaluate that in a certain set of under conditions, usually in some sort of, a lot of people use a Macbeth cabinet. And then you look at it, you save a piece of material in its original state, put that somewhere where it doesn't fade. You subject other pieces to some sort of something that make it fade, and then you compare that back to the original, and then you use these gradations of grayscale fade to determine that it's got, you know, it may have to be 3 or better, or 2 or better, or something like that. I think a lot of folks do a fair amount of chemistry, just like you might have kind of recognized and felt familiar with the examples that we had there from both chem service and lab instruments. You know, this is the prosaic kind of reference materials that are used every day to either verify and or calibrate pH meters. And in fact, just today, I got a call from a company that wanted to know specifically which providers of pH material that I was aware of that actually produces a 17034 accredited pH buffer. So I thought that was kind of the coincidence there was kind of peculiar. Now, other types of reference materials, sometimes it's inherent in the material itself. So, for example, people who do thermogravimetric analysis, use standards like an indium standard to check and verify their machine, their equipment. Indium has a known transition curve and things of that nature. So and if you notice, these are pretty much they're formed to fit into a variety of some different configurations of thermogravimetric. So it's not that they made it because they made it pure. They purified it. They didn't. It's traceable back to the actual properties that they know are the melt and transition properties of the indium standard. So in this case, this is a 99.99% pure indium. So there might be some other things in there, but it's like one part out of 10,000. About now, just I was looking for. When I was looking for this, I found this. Well, if 99.99 is not good enough for you, then here's 99.95. But by doing so, you'd say, well, who certified this? Well, it's what it, you know, they've tested it, they've assayed it, they've done things with it. It is what it is, and it's going to be, it will retain that property for a long period of time. And if it was to change, it would be changing into something other than indium, or something else is happened to it. So, I think we didn't have a deep dive into 17034, but I trust that you probably have a better appreciation for the the standard itself and what's involved in how it affects and reference material producers and how it affects reference material production, and what would get involved in many cases with how we would assess to the 17034 standard. But also, I think it also kind of puts it in context where what the interrelationships are with 17034 and other things such as either ISO 9001 and or 17025. So I got the, we have some time allotted for questions. They have a mechanism for you. I hope that folks have been asking questions as we go along. I just hope there's somebody out there that will give me the answers. Okay, so.
Thank you, Doug. I do have some questions for you, so I'll go ahead and read a few of those off. Okay, so our first question was from earlier, so maybe this may have got answered, but the question was, is what are the differences between a reference material certificate and a 17025 certificate?
Oh, well, a 17025 certificate, you're talking about things that would identify the material, you know, that being tested, any type of special environmental conditions that were, you know, part of testing if that would have an effect. You normally would have the description of the test method. You'd have a description of the specimens or specimens. You'd have the test results. It may or may not have uncertainty. It may or indicate it may be required that you indicate something's in limits, out of limits, acceptable, not acceptable, certain grade or whatever. And then there has to be an understanding of what's that process like. How is uncertainty handled and things of that nature, or what is the decision rule? In the reference material area, let me I can kind of read the content of reference material certificates and product information sheets shall include the following. Sometimes they'll call something, you know, so you might get an actual reference material certificate in terms of an analysis, but you also get a product information sheet that might have safety things on it or maybe storage things and disposal and so forth. So in general, it's the title. You got to have a title. It's got to be clear as what it is. A unique identifier of the reference material itself, the name of it, if it requires that, name and contact details of the RMP, the producer. What's the intended use? What is this going to be used for? Now that could be in the product sheet, or it could be in the certificate. What's the minimum sample size, if that's appropriate? You know, should you take out 10 milliliters, you know, and use that every time or something of that nature. The period of validity, storage information, instructions for handling and use that are sufficient to ensure the integrity of the material. Page number or total number of pages or some sort of indicator as you reach the end, if in fact you got multiple pages on the certificate, the document version, and then information on commutability of the material where that's appropriate. Now, in addition to that, reference material certificate shall contain the description of the CRM, the property of interest and the property value and associated uncertainty. Measurement procedure for operationally defining it. So it might be something that if you had a metal standard that would indicate that it should be used in a ICP, or if it would be used for ICP and AA analysis, metrological traceability of the certified values, and the name and function of the reference material producer's approving officer. Remember that what's one thing that somebody, you can't, is the approval of the documents is a key thing on a certificate. So it should have in on there that who's the approving officer person for the approving that certificate.
Okay, and then we have another question that just came in. Is it acceptable if the subcontractor also subcontracts the service you subcontracted to them to another subcontractor? A lot of subcontractors.
Yeah, well, there may be a reason for that. And I would think that what you'd have to do when you write your contract up with your subcontractor, that you put, you anticipate that or you recognize that. And so therefore you, in a sense, can reach through that contract to that next level of subcontractor. And that may be something that is part of the processing, but not a critical part of the processing, or it might be something that's fairly critical to it. I could see perhaps where somebody would say, well, we don't have the wherewithal to analyze this, but the characterization study is going to involve taking results from three or more laboratories. And then what would happen is you would have one contractor then handling getting the material out to those laboratories and getting it back, and then the data coming back up through to the reference material producer. I was recently part of a program internationally that, due to COVID, happened to, at an very inconvenient time for us in the United States. It was 3 in the morning. It was spread out over 3 days, but they were talking particularly about developing COVID PCR standards, among other things. And they had folks from both Korea and China and some other economies, but they were talking about how they had different laboratories do different processes of things at several tiers. And that would be analogous to this type of situation here.
Right. Okay. One last question. Do you see any impartiality concerns with a reference material producer owning a lab?
Oh, no, not necessarily. You mean the laboratory, even if they if they have a lab, then the lab would have to be able to produce valid results and do a conscientious job and things of that nature. Now, in terms of, you would think that I think you could probably hypothesize that there could be some finagling or nefarious activity there, but it's still the organization's own lab. So in these cases that we showed you demonstrate with the people that we have accredited plus a couple that we haven't shown, they have their own lab facilities. So I don't think there's inherently a contract conflict. I think that the standard integrity and confidentiality, impartiality that's in, say, 17025 and in 17034 would kind of at least set the stage where you're kind of handling that in a suitable manner.
Okay, great. One comment came up. You got a thank you for your presentation. It was very interesting. And the question was, will we be able to get a copy of the slides? The answer is yes. They'll be available on our website shortly after the conclusion of the webinar. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and we're going to wrap this up. We did go over a little bit today. Doug, I'd like to thank you very much. If there's any questions, I believe, Doug, if you flip the slide to the next one, there's our email addresses. You could contact us directly, and we'll be more than happy to answer your questions you have about this topic. Thank you very much, everyone, for attending, and have a great evening. Bye-bye.